Did he think that the world was just going to hell in a handbasket?
Well, yes, I think so. Mm-hmm.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
I think the best introduction to Ivan Illich is found in David Cayley's book, especially his introduction to that book. And then if you look at the chapters one by one, I think there's no better way to find out who Illich was.
What governed Ivan Illich's thinking? What inspired or motivated him?
Well, I would put that under three different headings. The first heading was where he stood as a person. I think there are three subdivisions or characteristics or that define him as a person with respect to where he was standing. And these three characteristics are his faith, that he was a man of faith, he was a believer, and he was a Roman Catholic. And I think that everything which he did in terms of his thinking, etc., is derived from that. The second point is he was concerned about the world, what's going on in the world. And there he's conceptualized everything under the notion of technology as it's outlined in books of Jacques Ellul, the Frenchman. And Ellul and Illich are sort of, I think, the preeminent people, that is in the English-speaking world and the French-speaking world, in centering their attention on the notion of technology and what it's doing to the society, what it's doing to human beings, and so on. The third thing, I think, is what he wanted was to try to find his own place in history, to insert himself in the history of his time, and then, as he understood European history very well, in the history of Europe, of which he considered to be his own history. I'm a European, he would say. What he did is to express all of this stuff in what I call an apophatic mode. That is, apophatic is a theological mode, which comes out of the Western tradition, of which Illich was aware. It really starts with Plato and people like that, but developed more with the early fathers of the church, and then most especially with the guy in the 6th or 7th century, the guy they call today Pseudo-Dionysius. And there are other thinkers one can cite and one tracing this kind of what I call this apophatic mode. And that's what I think what Illich was doing, and I think one can establish that pretty clearly. But it makes his stuff, what he wrote and so forth, unintelligible without this sort of, it's in a way, it's a kind of a key, it's a kind of an entrance to what he was all about. Well, I think that's important.
The concerns around the technology and what it's doing to society, could we just talk a little bit more about that? Because I think,
well,
it's coming to pass a lot, what he's talked about. And
he was interested, first of all, in the effects of technology, the actual effects, first of all, and later the symbolic effects. He would use an example. Say, a photograph. Okay, now at a certain point in history, the photograph was introduced into the 19th century into history. But this technological artifact, namely the photograph, changed people's perception so that he thought it was a serious question which people should try to look at and try to figure out. It's a serious question whether anyone sees anything today. period. Anyone who's exposed to photographs, say, where you see the person, whether you're able to see the person in front of you, see the nature, etc., whether you're able to see the people you claim to love and that kind of thing, you're not going to see them. That was his point. And what technology is doing is creating an artificial universe. That is an artificial universe, and a lot of it has to do with the question of perception. So he spent a lot of time on perception and how technology affects one's perception, what one sees. What he was saying is that he believed ultimately, he thought that technology was changing what we call as the human condition. That is, there he's coming out of a Thomistic perspective, St. Thomas Aquinas, in terms of human nature, and based first of all on Aristotle. And he's saying that these people had a certain notion of what it is to be human, what you call human nature, and technology is changing that. He would say, for example, well, are there any human beings around today? Do humans still exist? He would say that would be a serious question. I think Elul goes perhaps farther than Illich did. And in terms of, because Elul went on to try to look at the way to get out of this technology business. Yvonne believed that one could get out of it through friendship, and that goes back to the question of his notion of virtue within Greek society, and the whole question of whether you need a good society to be a good person, or whether you can be a good person in an evil society. And he thought that everything had to start from square one right now, today, so that perhaps through friendship, if one were able to exist in friendship, then one could get to beyond that, to be able to see, to be able to understand, to be able to relate to the mess that the world is in, and so on.
We can get back to that. I just wanted to backtrack and just say the idea of man created in man's image that he talked about, you know, the cosmos in man's hand.
Man created in man's image. Well, Illich would be absolutely against that, because he thinks that man, or whatever you want to call them, humans, are created in God's image, and he was very traditional in that. So that's why he was believing that the question of image is important. And he did a lot of writing on images. That is, these were very late writings. He thought that what is happening today is that people are recreating human beings, but it isn't in man's image. It's in a sort of a pseudo man, a kind of a technological artifact man. So that he actually used the word. It's a kind of perversion which is going on. He believed that because of what is going on in the medical system today, and with respect to death and so forth, that what we're doing is producing monsters. So that people under intensive medical care, as they approach death, become what he would call these are not humans any longer. These creatures, or whatever they are, well, he used the word monster and words like that. Now, obviously, there are people, like, for example, with respect to schooling, who learn in spite of schools. And so there are people who die in spite of medical technology, die their own death, like Illich. He spent a lot of time on words, so he would say, what is it to die transitively and intransitively and so on? So he would say, is it possible today to die? And he would think, well, no, it's not, because of technology. But the thing is, that subject of death and technology is not simple to get at. It's very complicated, and it would take a long time to actually delineate his meaning with respect to technology and its effect on human beings. He would carry this through in everything. That is, for example, every kind of vehicle he would think is a kind of a monstrosity, a kind of perversion. That is, once you take a person's feet off the earth and fly and that kind of thing, he would be very critical of that. He would be very critical of this kind of thing of talking on the phone over wires. He was critical of that.
But, you know, many people will think that, okay, this is like going back. Does he want to go back?
No. No, he says you got to live right now. You got to live in this world. We have to live in the modern world. So he would get into an airplane, for example. He would get into an automobile, for example, although realizing that this was not a good thing to do. And he would use things like telephone and so forth. But as he said, I would never want to speak to a person I love over the telephone. He never owned and never had any photographs of those friends and intimates. No, I would never have a photograph of someone whom I love. He would say, you have to live in this world, but you try to live with technology. and at the same time being critical of it in terms of trying to see what is good and what is bad in the whole question. And he placed a lot of emphasis upon what he called an askesis. He liked to use Greek words now and then, which we would say in English is an asceticism. And he said asceticism, went into it and explained it and so forth, is a lifelong process of trying to discipline your senses so that you are able to feel, to see, to smell, and so forth, to hear, and so on. And it's a lifelong disciplinary practices which one can use. I mean, you see that, for example, in people today who try to meditation and stuff like that. He did not go for that kind of stuff because he thought that anything which smacked of what he called New Age was just anathema to him. He just thought that was the most worst kind of junk you could imagine. And he was quite explicit and quite vocal about that. But he was very strong on the question of disciplines that are necessary in order to train oneself to be able to see, to hear, to smell, to taste, and so on.
Radio Frisco on CFMU.
The point is to be in the world, but not to be of the world. And he said that this was a kind of mystery which one had to figure out. Each one had to figure out, him or herself, because each one is going to be different. So that renouncing the world, it didn't mean that you closed yourself up in some sort of ivory tower, which he did not do, or go off to the desert someplace, which he did not do, because he was in the midst of everything all the time. But he was living, as I say, in what traditionally in the Roman Catholic tradition is called detachment. That is, he wasn't attached to any of these things. That is, the things, for example, a good wine or flowers or comfortable bed. Well, he didn't have that much of a comfortable bed because he just slept on a futon and I built up the rack on which the futon lay. But he felt that one could not become attached to any of these things. So I've seen him eat all kinds of junk and all kinds of and drink all kinds of stuff, and which I thought, well, this is crazy to eat and drink this way. But he could also enjoy a good meal or enjoy good wine and so forth. But was not attached to any of these things. So that the question of renouncing the world is the question of attachment, really. For example, he would give me clothing that his brother had given him. We were the same size, so I could get so-called good brother shirts or whatever, because his brother gave it to him thinking he got to wear something. He would like in rags, or not rags, but not very, you know, it'd be sort of torn, old stuff and so forth. His brother would go out and buy him these expensive things. And he would pass them on to me. I don't want that stuff. He says, I don't need that. So he would take what he needed, but that was all. He wouldn't take any more. The limits was very important to him. I mean, that's what he thought. What's going on today with respect to the society in general and with respect to the whole question of technology is denial of limits. And so he thought that this is how to be human, is to admit limits and admit finality and to admit the necessity to restrain ourselves, not to just embrace everything constantly without any kind of limit. So limits was very important to him in order to live a good life, that is, to live a life which he thought was a life of real joy, and as distinct to a life of pleasure. He was interested in a life of joy. For that, he thought limits were necessary. There isn't any absolute standard. He says, I'm not producing cookbooks. I'm not producing answers. That's not what I'm all about.
Do you want to just go back and talk about that idea of friendship, how that could help us navigate ourselves through this world?
He thought that we live in an awful society. The society is not going to do anything to encourage us to be good because it's just a mess. So the one thing he thought that could possibly save people, or not that isn't perhaps the proper word, the best word, is the notion of friendship. Now, friendship for him was caritas in Latin, or charity, that is, it was a grace, it was a supernatural thing, and he explained toward the end of his life why he was using philia, the Greek term, which comes out of Plato and Socrates, rather than caritas, the Latin for the Christian term, of charity, of loving one's neighbor and so on. And he explained, he said, well, I'm speaking to this world of people who are non-Christian. So he tried to speak about them about in a kind of secular way, that's perhaps not the best word, but in a kind of a non-religious way of friendship, according to a Greek model and a Greek inspiration, rather than in a Christian way, which is where he really was in terms of his own feelings, his own beliefs, and so on. So friendship, he thought, there's sort of infinite possibilities. There, the way one could be a friend to another, and the various ways in which one could explore this question of friendship. This was an entry point, he thought, into the reality, or the what he would call sometimes call the horror of the modern world. So that he would say, well, friends are everything. That is, without my friends, I would just be nothing, I mean, in a sense. And then, of course, one of the props key notion and all of that with respect to friendship is what he called hospitality. That is, to be an hospitable host. His door was always open in the sense that anyone who could come in, like I've seen all kinds of crazy people come in, living with him over various years. And so he felt that it was supremely important to be hospitable to the stranger and to friends. He did this. And so for him, and there are people I know who interpret Illich in terms just of hospitality. They say, well, that's the most important thing that he had to say in his life and interpret his life from that perspective. There is some truth in that.
Did he think that the world was just going to hell in a handbasket?
Well, yes, I think so. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that too?
I feel much perhaps stronger about that than he did. Oh, yes, I think there's no hope in a sense.
That's very discouraging.
That's why he would say, I don't speak this way to young people because it's just too horrible. I can't say these things. And so he would talk to me about his view that way. But he wouldn't very often actually come out and be explicit with respect to others. At the same time, I think I would go back to what I originally said, that he was a man of faith. So he believed, well, this world could go to hell in a handbasket because it doesn't make that much difference anyway, because there's another world in which I believe. And that's the one in which I want to die. He was a very, he was a peculiar kind of person in the sense that he was a genuine believer. So while he was looking at the world and seeing what it was, he also was not discouraged. He was not depressed because he saw that there is more than what meets the eye. He was very active in Europe, protesting the implantation of Pershing missiles in Germany, and he supported people who were in the Green Party in Europe, and he did a lot of behind-the-scenes work supporting people when Pinochet overthrew Allende in Chile and when Goulart was overthrown in Brazil. Illich did a lot of stuff behind the scenes, very active with respect to Camilo Torres in Colombia. Those are just instances which come to mind off the top of my head, and took a very active part in terms of the things that were going on in the world. He would really work for what he thought were good things. Mm-hmm. So he said, well, who knows what will come of it.
And how about yourself? I read that you started homesteading. Do you want to talk about that experience too?
I wrote a book on the subject. I thought, well, Illich was talking about subsistence. He says, well, the modern world was produced by the war against subsistence. That's the whole point of modernity. And so I said, well, if that's true, would it be possible to live, to the extent that one could do it today, in a subsistent mode, would it be possible to do that comfortably? So my wife and I built this house ourselves, and, well, the first thing I think you have to decide, if you want to try to live outside this economy, is to get rid of electricity, and then next to get rid of the phone. So we got rid of these things, and I found that what one could do, one could live comfortably, one could live in beauty, because people who saw our house said it was one of the most beautiful things they had ever seen, and one could do that and could survive. That is, I thought I lived very well. I was selling my excess produce at the local farmer's market, and from that I could live. And so I was tied in to the larger economy or whatever, because I'd have a pickup truck to get the produce to the farmer's market and so on. So, again, you don't turn your back on the whole question of the modern world, but you try to live in it, and I wanted to try to live and see if we could do it enjoyably. So we took our kids out of school, and they just grew up sort of wildly there on the farm. It was a question of no school of any sort. Of course, it was kind of a totalitarian thing because they had no choice. They had to just do it because we did it. I think that the point is that children growing up have to see what goes with what. That if you want water, it has to come from someplace. The kids saw, as we were working things out to get water into the house, so there'd be water, there would be some water to drink, water for irrigation, and so on. And they had to see, well, if you want to get rid of waste matter, whether it's fecal matter or garbage or whatever, how do you get rid of it? You don't just flush toilets. We had no flush toilet. We had a composting toilet. So they had to learn what went with what. And if you want a shelter, like when we moved there, we were living in a tent, and we started building a house. We knew we had to get it finished enough to move in for the winter because the winters there were cold, and we got enough finished to move in the winter. And so there was a roof over our heads. And that's the whole point, I think, of children growing up, is to know the connections, to know what is connected with what. I see here where I'm living now in Philadelphia that people will turn on the hot water, for example, and just let it run. Well, you can't do that. That's a sin against the water and everything else. And the whole, or people will throw away garbage, throw away food they're not eating. Well, you can't do that. The kids saw all that kind of thing, so that they, I think they learned from all that. If I were to do it again, I would do the same thing. Yeah, I'd even be more lenient or less directive in terms of what they would do and not do. I think John Holt is correct on that. I think John Holt is right. I hadn't read Holt at the time, that you let kids grow like weeds, and they'll grow up all right. But the difficulty was, why I would not encourage anyone else to do this, is that it was different. We were out so far in the boondocks, so far out all by ourselves, and then surrounded by a forest, that is, it was a national forest. So the little piece of land we had in the middle of it, the kids could run all day in the forest and that kind of thing. Well, this is not what you can do in a city. My wife and I planned all this ahead of time, what we were going to do, where we were going to do it, and all that kind of thing. And so although we were serious and we did it, I wouldn't, it's again something like some of the stuff Illich would say, it isn't something that has to be, that should be imitated or copied by other persons, but say, well, okay, there's something that's been done, and perhaps I can do what I am able to do within my limits and my conditions and my circumstances and so on. But I see this kind of exemplar in front of me. Like, for example, when I first went there, I read Scott Nearing, which I was very impressed by him. And I don't think one could imitate Scott Nearing, but one could take that as a kind of exemplar of an ideal, sort of, that one would hold before himself, as I did at that time.
How did the children manage? How did they turn out?
Well, it's funny because our daughter, she's now 35 or so, she says, I now understand what you wanted to do, and I'm really grateful that we grew up that way, and I see the importance of it. And, of course, she's on a farm in Oregon, but she also picked up a PhD. So she's a funny kind of person. The two kids are very different. Ben, our son, he refused all schooling of any kind, and he refused to do anything in high school at the time of the divorce. So the kids, we put them in a high school at that time because we couldn't reproduce what we were doing there because we were separated. And so Ben, my wife understood that very well. So she put Ben in a school that had no sort of requirements or it'd be very easy on people. So he took like basket weaving type courses and things like that and got, I don't know how he ever got a diploma to graduate in that place. But then he would have nothing to do with schooling from that day on after he finished that. And to this day, he refuses. But he gets along very well. They're very different, but they're also very much alike. Illich, it's very hard to say his influence because since I met him in 1960 and I've lived with him for many, many years, my wife said, what are you going to do when this guy dies? Because your whole life has been centered around him. I said, well, I don't know. I get along very well, and I think I do. That is, I'm glad he's dead because being close to him, you see how much he suffered, how much he was in pain, and I thought, it was very good that he died. He should have died much sooner. I think, like this new book I just finished, is you see every chapter in it is influenced by Illich in some way. And right now I'm doing various things, working on projects to make his thought known, which I think it's not known as widely as I think it should be. The book is just one step in that process. And so I'm working on other articles, perhaps another book now, and I give talks and stuff like that to try to articulate what he thought and what he stood for and to make these ideas and his life better known. I think that Illich's books are important, and I think that, as Illich said himself, you don't read these books as you read a newspaper. And so, although I work with him on a number of the books, some people would say trying to make them more intelligible, but there is ideas, and they require some work to understand what he's all about. And I would say, I think that, for example, Gender, which I think is the most important book he ever wrote, is not reviewed, and there's one review of it, one very important review. But other than that, it's never mentioned in any bibliography, and nobody reads it, and no one knows it. But it's a theory of economics, which, if one were to take it seriously, would have to reinterpret what is called the social history of Europe. And I think it's powerful enough that it requires that kind of rethinking of what is called the social history of Europe. So Illich, in many things like that, he had certain ideas which are like his book on tools for conviviality is a theory of technology. And no one has ever come anywhere near those five dimensions that Illich talks about there. The only thing that they talk about technology is the first dimension, which Illich dismisses almost immediately. And he says these other four are more important. Well, he gives some importance to each one of them. He says, unless you have all five of these dimensions, unless you're looking at all of them, forget about it. Bits and pieces of people saying, I mean, doing all kinds of good things here and there and saying all kinds of important things. But I would just argue that I think Illich, too, was saying something that could perhaps be taken into account.
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.